Welcome back to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. When a collector in Brussels found a trunk of Native American artifacts in 2004, no one could have guessed the history that would be uncovered. The collection of more than 150 artifacts of regalia and crafts were left behind by Lakota people who performed at the Brussels International Exposition in 1935. Some of those performers were from South Dakota and had first traveled overseas with Buffalo Bill's Wild West show decades before. The collector, Francois Schladiouk, traveled to the Buffalo Bill Museum and Grave near Denver to learn more about this collection. That's where he formed a friendship with the museum's director, Steve Friesen. Friesen's new book, Lakota Performers in Europe, documents Schladiouk's collection with vivid photographs. It also explores the history of Wild West shows in Europe and the stories of some of those Lakota performers. Friesen spoke with SDPB's Jackie Hendry about the day Schladiouk visited his museum.
It really was something where I get this call. There's this tall guy from Brussels here, and he's got some TV people with him, and he wants to talk to you. And I get in, and he's just sort of, here he is, and he's just really excited and enthusiastic and telling me all about these artifacts that he has discovered and how he's on his way to Pine Ridge. And he is here to check some things out about Buffalo Bill, and that he thinks some of the performers who were in Brussels were part of Buffalo Bill's Wild West, and we're going on and on. And so then we go into our photo archive and immediately find a photograph that I had thought was from Buffalo Bill's Wild West, which was actually from 1932, a little later on than that, and he was able to identify it. It's one of the photos, actually, I think he has a better copy that we use in the book, and it's the photo of the little boy fountain, Mannequin Piss, which is the little peeing boy that's made Belgium famous probably more than anything else as a tourist site. It's in the book, and what makes it rather significant to the book is that they dressed, and this is a custom when people who are visiting dignitaries from other countries or different ethnic backgrounds, they dress the little boy in their ethnic clothing. So the Lakota dressed him, this is in 1932, in the clothing of their background, and then that outfit is in Brussels, in the City Museum of Brussels. So that's there, and then, of course, all of these things that were brought later, most of them in 1935, that Francois acquired are all there, too. But anyway, it was just this amazing experience, and all of a sudden I'm being interviewed by a Belgian television network, and somehow or other we just hit it off, and we've been friends ever since. That was 2006.
For people who might not know the history of Wild West shows, can you give us a little preview, maybe during Buffalo Bill's time in the early 1900s, and what made these shows so successful in Europe?
Well, Buffalo Bill sort of created the first Wild West show in 1883, and he started touring the United States. Mark Twain said, you know, you should take this to Europe because this is truly an authentic picture of what life was like in the American West. So he does indeed go to Europe in 1887, to England first, then he's back here for a year and then goes to France and tours around until 1892. And then he goes again 1902 to 1906. And this is the first Wild West show he has copied, and so there are more Wild West shows traveling in the United States and indeed traveling Europe. But he is, of course, the best known and the juggernaut with whom they cannot compete. And this repeated visitation to Europe by the Wild West shows helps reinforce what they read in everything from James Fenimore Cooper's novels to dime novels that were being furnished, the newspaper articles that were about the American West. And there it was, right in front of them. Everybody, the cowboys, and most importantly, the Lakota. The Lakota, who were so impressive in their reenactment of their culture, and that had an indelible imprint upon people in Europe, and it still has today.
Why do you suppose Buffalo Bill shows were that juggernaut as far as Wild West shows in Europe?
Well, the other people just didn't have the name recognition, and many of them didn't have the background. He lived that West that he was showing in his show, and some of the others were kind of imitators, and they didn't really have the credentials. His was a juggernaut in the sense just of its size. 650 people were part of the show. That includes all the backup personnel, not just the performers, but they had to have a massive cooking area and a lot of cooks. and people to shoe and care for the horses. So it was a large show, and the largest then that traveled across Europe when it was in Europe.
You acknowledge in your book that today many people look at these shows and the use of Lakota performers as being exploitative, but you don't see historical evidence for that.
There is no evidence, at least certainly when you look at the big shows. There may have been some small rinky-dink operations where they did some inappropriate things, but it's quite the opposite. First off, people who say that are insulting the Lakota of the time. They were not naive children of the forest who needed some sort of protection from these terrible Wild West show operators. It wasn't that at all. They were looking for the opportunities that the operators offered, opportunities to get off the reservations, which were nasty and brutish places to be for the Lakota. It's still tough on the reservation. That's one thing. They were looking for a financial opportunity, an opportunity to see the world. And finally, these Wild West shows offered them a way that they could both preserve and present their culture. And everybody at that time, in the way of the government agents and these so-called reformers who said, oh, they were being exploited, they were all trying to keep the Indians back on the reservation and turn them into little Anglo-looking farmers. And they didn't want them to maintain their culture. They wanted to kill the savage and save the man. That's what they literally said. Well, first off, the misunderstanding was that they were savages in the first place, because that was kind of the way people talked. And the second aspect of misunderstanding was their culture was to be valued. So this was not exploitation, this was opportunity.
I liked your exploration in the book about kind of the Indian policy of the time, the letters back and forth with superintendents. How do we keep them here because they're performing and they're not farming like we want them to be?
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm curious, when you first set out to do this project, if you knew how much of a role that Indian policy was going to play just in whether or not they were performing or what success they found in performing.
Well, there was a book on Indian performers in Wild West shows by a guy named L.G. Moses, which I had read previously, and that sort of put the idea in my head, hey, there's a different way of looking at this.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a little bit aware of that, but I think when I started work on this, I was going to do a book about 1935 and just that. But the more I started exploring it, looking at the sweep of history, all the stories that went back to Buffalo Bill and his first visit with Lakota in 1887, I realized there was a much bigger story here, and a story that spoke well of the Lakota and well of the people who employed them. And I'm not really of the school that says, well, we can sit here with our 21st century hindsight and sit in judgment upon the people of the past. I don't agree with that. I think we need to evaluate and discuss it. But in this case, sitting in judgment only means I'm judging the people of the 21st century who are misunderstood. These folks were doing the right thing. They were way ahead of our time, their times, and more like our time. When Buffalo Bill says the Indians have to be accorded this respect, they need to get equal rights. You know, this is important stuff, and he's saying in the 1890s. And I think the other thing, the strength and bravery that these Lakota showed, leaving that within which they had lived all their lives and going to another country, and the actual enthusiasm with which many of them embraced that opportunity. And they did it. And they made a mark. They made a huge influence on the way people in Europe think about the United States. And I think it was a positive influence, not a negative one. Because they were saying, hey, the Lakota have things of value here. And, of course, today I mention in the book about how at the Pitti Palace in Florence, you have all these masters by Da Vinci and Raphael and Titian. And in the same building, in slightly different rooms, you have Lakota Indian materials at a special exhibit that they did. In some ways, you could say almost on a par with what the old masters were doing back in Florence. They're finally getting the accord. They're finally getting the praise, the recognition that they deserve.
You talked about you were originally just going to focus on 1935. So
yeah, right.
Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show has ended in that time. but in 35, some of the same Lakota performers take part in an exhibition in Brussels. Tell us a little bit about that particular exhibition.
Well, the Brussels exposition is kind of, and I'm not sure that people realized it, but it was kind of the last gasp of these kind of shows, because then World War II comes and things really change, as I point out in the book. But what happens in Brussels is you have some of the continuity from people like Sam Lone Bear, who started performing with Buffalo Bill in 1894 and continued to perform all the way to 1935. So you have that continuity of some people who experienced the very early reservation period, and they spent time with people who had actually been warriors. But in their cases, they were actually of that next generation. And then you have newer performers who are of a different generation, who are the young folks, like the Little Moons. And they're performing for whatever their rationale. They decide to perform and get to see another country, and this becomes a very important thing for them and their descendants that they did this. And so you have this kind of bridge arcing from the 1890s, all the way to 1935, with changing Lakota culture, but also Lakota culture that they're preserving. And then in 1935, of course, it all changes. So 1935 becomes, in my mind, a kind of a pivotal moment where the old ways of performing are continued. The new ways of performing, like the powwow, are just really starting to gain in strength. And that's kind of it. And then they have all these artifacts that they leave that demonstrate that performance period. So you have people with their collections in these museums that are sort of pre-reservation or early reservation time. But they don't reflect this period of performance where the Lakota were finding the middle ground, where they could keep their culture but modify it so it could be used in performance as well. And so that's kind of, to me, a very unusual collection. We may discover more similar collections as we look around, but it's kind of a different way of looking at Lakota artifacts.
And these artifacts are left to a butcher named August Hermans?
Yeah. He is enthusiastic. His father first took him to see some of the Indians, and you see this in the book, in 1910 at an earlier exposition. And his father buys a few things, which they keep in the family and which also were among the materials that Francois bought. And so August Hermans, in 1935, actually meets some people who he's met a couple times earlier as they've been traveling. So he has some sort of relationships with some of the performers in the group of, they're basically 15 people. And that relationship continues. There's a possibility that because he was a butcher, he was actually providing meat to them. So he builds this relationship, and when they leave at the end of the fair, they gift him with some items, and he buys some items, which he then keeps. And most of those items are rarely seen. We have a few pictures of him wearing some items when he took part in some of these Indian hobbyist events that happened in Brussels, but very rarely did he do that. Most of the artifacts he keeps in these trunks in his house, and nobody sees them from 1935 until he dies in the 1980s, and then they're in the estate, nobody sees them, and then 2004 is when Francois acquires them, and nobody knows what they are. They're just a bunch of Indian things. And Francois begins doing research and discovers they came from that 1935 fair. And then he finds photos of them being used by the performers during their performances during the fair. And all of a sudden we have this really strong provenance that's developed by him over time. And then, you know, he and I continue working together with that material as we move into the book.
And tell me about, in your personal process, the moment that you decided you would be the one to write this book and what that research and writing process was like for you.
Well, my book on Buffalo Bill had come out and it was doing well. And Francois had come to me and said, well, you've done a book. I need to find somebody who would write this book for me. And can you give me some advice on how to look for somebody? So I gave him some advice. He was looking for somebody in Europe to do it. And he was having no success at all. He finally said, Steve, I just can't find anybody. And I said, well, Francois, you know, I could do it. I don't want to force myself on you with this project. He said, oh, Steve, I thought you were too busy. So it was like both of us thought this would be a good idea. We just didn't bother to talk to each other. And then it just happened then. So there was this moment. I think when I was visiting him at his shop in 2011 when this kind of dawned on us.
I'm wondering if there are any individuals in this book who especially stood out to you or that you connected with as you were researching and writing this.
Yeah. My favorite character, and there are several of them, but in terms of the Lakota performers, is Sam Lone Bear. Sam Lone Bear is a curious fellow, an interesting guy. He went to Europe 9 times. He learned French and German in addition to knowing English and Lakota. He had been trained at the Carlisle School that was one of the efforts to sort of kill the Indian, save the man. And what he ended up doing was using his knowledge of English and the world that he gained there to go out and perform wearing his people's cultural accoutrements. So he did all of that. And then one of the other things I ran across was people used to confuse him with a different Sam Lone Bear who was a peyotist. And it wasn't so much that he was a peyotist was the issue, but that other Sam Lone Bear got himself into a mess, including being thrown in prison for human trafficking. And they were trying to say Sam Lone Bear, who performed, was the same guy. And this has been the standard wisdom up until I started doing more research. And I found that here we had Sam Lone Bear in 2 places at one time. This was not possible. That indeed, there were 2 different fellows. The Sam Lone Bear that I admire, who learned French and German, and then the Sam Lone Bear, who was the peyotist who got involved in human trafficking. So he's just a fascinating character. And it turns out, I think he's probably the cousin or a relative of the Sam Lone Bear. The Sam Lone Bear, the performer, is related to the other guy, which is in a different dimension as well. Interesting family gatherings, perhaps. I don't know.
Beyond documenting this really unique collection of artifacts, what do you hope that this book does?
I think I'd like to see people looking at the Lakota performers and the people that they hired them in a new way. I want people to say, wait a minute, these people are not exploited. They were smart. They knew what they were doing. They found an opportunity to do what they enjoyed, to see the world, to get paid, and to perform their culture. When back on the reservation, it was denied to them, and they had to do it secretly, if at all. And I think that they were one of the things that sort of kept a sort of cultural genocide from being practiced against the Lakota, because their culture remained. And I want people to look at it that way and see the positive of all this, instead of saying all this negative stuff that has no truth about them being exploited or terrible things being done to them by the Wild West show organizers. That is not what I uncovered at all. I uncovered very positive things. I have to say, it was a lot of fun working on this, and I am by no means a Lakota expert. I'm not Lakota, of course, and I haven't spent that much time working at Lakota history and all of that, but I have to say that the opportunity to look at the Lakota through this lens of the Wild West shows and through these artifacts has been, it's just added a whole new dimension to my life that I'm really enjoying. And I'm still not an expert, but I have certainly become an enthusiast.